Welcome back to the Dear Katie podcast. This is Katie Kastner.
And this is Claire Kaplan. Once again, I want to remind our listeners that sometimes our discussions in the podcast are rather difficult to hear or emotionally trying. So we'd like to encourage all of you to care for your safety and well-being. Please reach out for emotional support from family or friends, a counselor if you have one, or even a hotline. Additional resources can be found on the Take Back the Night Foundation website, and we'll give you that address at the end of the podcast.
Thank you so much, Claire. And as we start our podcast always with a lovely intro from our special guest, today we have with us Blake, all the way, I believe, from Arizona. But we always like to start out, Blake, a little bit about who you are, where you grew up, and a kind of a brief bio. So would you be willing to share that?
I will. Why I'm Blake, I was born in Gary, Indiana, just outside of Chicago, the steel mill communities there, raised with four siblings. And I moved here 19 years ago to Phoenix, and that's where I currently live. I am married. My spouse, he's an airman in the United States Air Force, you know, and I am now an artist that also advocates for rape and PTSD survivors around the country.
Amazing. What kind of artist are you, Blake?
A very different kind. I didn't expect to become an artist, but it all started, you'll find out, in this journey 8 years ago. It's called social practice artwork. And maybe I can go into that a little bit more, but the medium is the interaction that I have with human beings. And so far, I've had interactions with 32,342 complete strangers over these last 8 years. And again, maybe I'll have a chance to go into that a little bit more, but it's a massive display of artwork I put together with all these tens of thousands of strangers.
Amazing. Well, we'll definitely have to talk a lot about that, Blake, as we get, you know, closer to what's been helpful in your healing. But I know we need to get a handle on what it is that brings you as a survivor to the microphone today.
It is a trauma. It was a rape that I went through. Sometimes people say, oh, gosh, it's probably not easy for you to talk about that as a guy. I don't think it's easy to talk about if I was a woman. Like, I don't think it's easy for anybody to talk about. I do know there are some challenges with boys and men, and that's really what brought me, the three of us, together. And about 2 months ago, I wrote a guest commentary for the Arizona Republic, and it got picked up around the country, which is a good thing because it did open up a lot of dialogues with men and boys to talk about our traumas. And my trauma specifically, is it okay to share now what had happened to me?
Absolutely.
It was just about 11 years ago, I woke up. I was in my 7th floor loft in downtown Phoenix, and three men came in. I was stripped naked. I was held down, beaten, raped. I was nearly thrown off of a 7th floor balcony that night before all the police came. And the second wave of the trauma, and sometimes I have to be real careful about talking about the second wave of the trauma that hit that night. And I'll explain why, but after I share this, I'll explain why. The four responding police officers that night categorically dismissed the rape because I'm a gay man. And I know that because several years ago, a commander and lieutenant of the Phoenix Police did meet with me and a third party, the Arizona Coalition to End Sexual Domestic Violence. And they stated to us, it was obvious, in their words, they said it was obvious that these four responding officers dismissed the rape because I'm a gay man. That was the second wave of the trauma. Sometimes people think the rape was horrific. Well, it was. But to sit there and think that, like, for so long, I just thought, what did I do wrong? Like, what? Like, I made a 911 call. You could, if you read the transcript, it's heartbreaking. I'm not sure any of my family and some of my close friends have ever read the transcript because I think it's too hard for people sometimes because you literally see that you're hearing the rape live. And as you're reading that transcript, so that dispatcher heard it. She heard my pleas. And it's just tough that I'm sitting there in my loft and all these officers arrive. It's a 600 square foot loft. I have seven men standing around me in a bloody crime scene, broken furniture. I'm in torn, ripped, bloody underwear. And that's all I was able to put back on. And I told them that these guys did this to me. And it's just, and I sometimes people have asked this question, did you know these guys? Oh, I knew all three of them. One of them had been my domestic partner for almost a decade at that point. He struggled with alcohol problems and he let them all in that night and they were drunk. And you both probably know this, Katie and Claire, that people can say, well, I was drunk. I was on drugs. I didn't know what I was doing. Well, guess what? For the rest of my life, I'll remember everything you guys were doing that night. And I still, even if we do or don't know our perpetrators, I don't know if sometimes people feel like, oh, well, then it wasn't so bad. You knew these guys. I literally have had people say that to me. Well, it wasn't so bad because you knew them. And I thought, no, if you read one of the stories I wrote for one of my editors, it was a Halloween story and I turned it, it was about my rape. And it was, I called the guys shapeshifters. I didn't know who they were. So sometimes I wish people would think before they speak because sometimes they're trying to, I get it. They're trying to be nice and they're trying to be understanding and empathetic, but sometimes, oh, it wasn't so bad because of this. And it's like, no, it really was that bad, guys.
Yeah. And it's, in some ways, it's not a matter of comparatives, but when you know the people, the betrayal is so much worse.
Oh, gosh. Yes.
Well, Blake, my first question, and then I know Claire will go back and forth, but I hear you talking about at least three items that I think we should go over. One is you have a partner, which you said you're married and you have a partner, and yet you're struggling with betrayal. And I think we could talk a little bit about what it means to feel a lack of trust. And then does it trickle into any of your other life aspects, including your relationship? I'd love to talk about that concept of trust and betrayal first. And then secondly, I think we should definitely talk about the discrimination you face as a gay man going through this and where you think, what else should we do? And how does that, what might have been unique? And then lastly, you know, this healing journey. So we could divide our conversation into three segments, if that sounds okay to you. And Claire and I can help navigate. Claire, do you want to add a fourth or do you think that's pretty good?
Well, I think we should explore abuse within a relationship. And I realize that this guy, I'm assuming you were no longer in the relationship with this guy. I'm not sure. But domestic violence within LGBTQ relationships, because that's something that people don't talk about very much, or they hold stereotypical images of that kind of thing. Does that sound okay, Ron?
Yeah, that sounds
good. Blake, we might confuse our listeners.
Blake, sorry. Yes, Blake. Sorry.
Well, I will, the betrayal, I know you asked about that. How does it affect my relationship? Well, the relationship I'm in now, I did have struggles. I pushed away against my spouse. When we first met 7 years ago, I didn't know that one of my friends at that point had said, hey, have you been dating anybody? Are you getting serious with anybody? And I said, no. And he said, I find that hard to believe. And then I said, you know what? Actually, there is a guy. But in my mind, it couldn't ever happen again. I didn't know that I could ever trust anybody again. And so my friend Jeremy, when he was asking that, I just thought, well, this is right. Why have I not talked about this to anybody? I mean, for months we had been seeing each other and talking. And I think I just imagined that, nope, stuff like that only happens to other people and it won't ever happen to me. And it was that, it's that sense of betrayal, not a sense of betrayal. It was
betrayal. Yes. Yeah.
And what was also difficult is that it does impact that relationship that you're having with somebody, because sometimes they're thinking, well, why aren't you letting me know about this? And you have to feel people out, because you're thinking, here's this guy that, I'll be honest with you, both of you and your listeners, I didn't come out of the closet till I was 35. And for all intents and purposes, I just never had sex with anybody. I always just dismissed it as I was just working on my life and I was very professional and doing things in my life. So if you will, I waited 35 years of my life to do anything with somebody. And I met this guy and I trusted him with everything. And that night, it's like almost like a fairy tale, like the person in your fairy tale just does this to you. And it was just destructive beyond, it's just hard to process. Imagine waiting 35 years of your life and doing nothing with anybody and then him. So that's also what made this even more traumatic.
But Blake, what I really love about what you said, it was very helpful for our listeners too, is destruction by the prince and the princess of your fairy tale, or that the mermaid or whatever it is. I think when our dreams and hopefulness for what idyllic life could look like are shattered and smashed and trampled upon, it's really hard to recover from that and find a new fairy tale that you can trust in and believe in. And you use the word betrayal. And so I imagine, I'm just sitting with you for a moment, like, I imagine you have to re-script what that fairy tale looks like for you now.
Well, and I do. And I don't know if I shared with either of you, because I know we had some discussions via email and phone before this interview, but there was something I was also not just diagnosed with PTSD, I was diagnosed with dissociative amnesia, and I didn't really know what the heck it was. And now it makes sense why the doctors did that. It's just, I didn't remember what happened that night, only bits and pieces. And the best way I can share and describe it with people in the audience would be, if you ever saw Matt Damon, the Jason Bourne series of movies, there were three or four of them in that series, and they were so popular. So I like to bring it up because the character Jason Bourne, played by Matt Damon, he had that same diagnosis as me. It was a dissociative amnesia, and you don't remember. And throughout those movies, that character is trying to fight the bad guys and gals. But as he's doing it, he's trying to understand, like, what happened to me? And so I wondered why in this journey people would say, you remind me of Jason Bourne. You're strong. You're determined. And it finally clicked this last year. I thought, oh my gosh, like, I didn't know that's what they were referring to. And I'm bringing that up because I stayed with my ex-partner after that night. And this may confuse some of the listeners. Why would you stay with somebody after something that vicious and horrific that he did to you? But you all have to understand that there were seven men in that room with me after that 911 call. And all seven men said the same thing. This didn't happen.
And then Blake.
Wow.
Yeah, I know, Blake, that's great. I think our listeners are going to honor you so much and sit and support you and hopefully post in when your episode's released. But I'm just wondering about one more thing. This is really critical to me. Like, the stereotype, Blake, is you could have a woman victim in a room with seven men who are calling her out on what she was wearing, her past sexual history, not believing her. How do you think the dialogue and how you were treated and the types of questions that they asked or the way in which they interacted with you might be really different? Like, I'm imagining, here's a few things I'm going to just riff upon. I think sometimes when I was in the police station, I was the male officer. I was worried. I was so conscious, I would say, of how he was looking at me. Like, I thought he was hetero and I was just thinking, what he's envisioned me in this dress, and he's asking him all these very sexual, what was I wearing? So I felt like an object in a male hetero way. I bet how you felt with seven men, I don't know, I could go into a lot of detail, but I think you experienced something radically different from me, but it's also equally valid. And I'm curious about all the, that moment must have been, I think we should talk about a little bit more,
The objectification?
Well, I would say the objectification, or how you felt as a gay man, whether these, were they all, did you, I don't know that you can tell if someone's hetero or not by looking at them. You can't. There's no way of objectively knowing. But I will tell you, the way that police officer in my case, Blake, looked at me, I was pretty sure he was either bi or hetero. Because just the way he asked the questions and the nuances of what he was, the way he said every word, the types of questions made me feel like an object again. And now I'm already worried about seven men in one room feeling like ganged up upon for you. I think it's really interesting to explore that if you're okay and willing to talk about it.
I'm willing to explore. When they entered the room, I remember also that, I'm going to name another movie, but the movie with Russell Crowe, Gladiator. For maybe 4, 5, 8 minutes, I had to hold these guys off. I was picking up pillows. I was picking up different things in the loft to hold these guys off so that they weren't getting at me. And I felt like a gladiator. Like, I literally had three tigers coming at me and screaming and yelling. And I, mind you, I was very sick this night. That's why I was in bed. I was trying to sleep. And I don't know. I talked to doctors afterwards when I started opening up and learning more about what happened that night. And When the one guy, I got off the bed and I was finally, quote unquote, free of the guys on the bed, I grabbed one of the perpetrators and I threw him into a dresser. It hit the wall. It broke the furniture. There was blood splattering. And somebody said, I thought you were sick that night. How did you do that? And the doctor said to me, it was probably sheer adrenaline that I was able to just And I didn't know how much I had in that gladiator, those 7-8 moments or whatever, those minutes when I'm waiting for the police, I was on the phone. I don't know how I held them off. And doctors said, you don't need to worry about that. Whatever adrenaline you had, it potentially saved your life. They were just out of freaking control. But as you said, what was it like to have these 7 men? Was there objectification? I do know that one of the officers walked over to me. The rest were talking to the other 3. And he said, I'm going to give you some advice you might not want to have, especially that one guy. He pointed to one of the perpetrators and said, we know him. He's trouble. It's probably not a good idea you have him here. And I looked and said, you do know I'm the one that called 911. Like, I didn't invite these men in. This isn't something that I... So they were looking at me like I was getting lectured. I mean, imagine that. Like, I just called 911. You guys heard, like, the dispatcher heard it. And she at one point said to me, I remember the phone got disconnected. Then she called back and then nobody answered. Then she called, but I was trying to fend these guys off. And she got on the phone with me. And this forever probably will be the most horrific moment of my life. What I'll tell you next is... It wasn't the rape. It was actually, and it wasn't what the officers did. On that 7th floor balcony, I'm looking over downtown Phoenix. It's late, 11 o'clock, I'm guessing, at night. And she said, oh, honey, who's yelling at you right now? And there was 3-4 second pause. And she said it again. And I said, I'm not really sure. You have to get here. And she said, honey, I've sent all the units. They're coming. Just hang tight. And then the phone went dead. It was hard because that was my partner. He was screaming at me and he was trying to come at me. And the other guy, from my understanding, they were trying to get out of the place before the cops arrived. They knew I had just called. And it was heartbreaking for me because my brain couldn't work that fast. I just, at that moment, I thought there's no way, like the biggest villain in my life is my partner. And there's no way. It wasn't that I was trying to cover for him. I thought for years I was trying to cover for him. I just couldn't understand in that short period of time how somebody could be, if you will, a shapeshifter. Like they were going to kill me that night. I went over the edge of the balcony at one point after that call. The guy pushed me against the railing, but I couldn't understand how he could sit back and do that to me. And he was going to let me go to my death. And that was the hardest part of all of that betrayal. And then I did, at one point, I was able to get back inside the loft. And when I did, there was a distinguished, it's like the sound people say in a restaurant when you hear glass breaking, everybody stops. It's that distinct. There was a knock on the door and I knew that was a different sound than I had heard for, 15 minutes? And I knew it was probably the police, and it was, but I don't know if they objectified me, but I just know they wouldn't listen to me. And there was some biases that they all brought in there, because if I live to be 1,000 years old, I'll never understand how they could have walked into that crime scene and then heard the 911 dispatcher say, you guys have to get there, it is urgent. And then you get there, and they actually drove one of the perpetrators home that night. Unbelievable.
God, what a horrible scene. What a horrible experience you had. It makes me think that I'm reminded of a story that I was told this many years ago of, people have their own biases or stereotypes in their mind. And a woman was in a relationship with another woman, and they were a couple, and I guess one of the women was home and the other was not, and some men broke in and raped her because there was a big fight that had ensued, and the other woman arrived home after, and they called the police, and the cops walked in, and what did they say? We know how you dykes fight.
Oh, wow, Claire, so powerful.
And that's that kind of thing where totally dismissed, right, because of who they were. Now, that was many years ago. But I'm just thinking, how many people still experience that? And you did.
All the time, I'm sure. Oh my goodness, we're sitting alongside you, and so sorry, Blake. But you know, I think one thing you can gift our listeners with is a little bit about your survivorship and how you've navigated that so well, and highs and lows. What's been most helpful? What's been most difficult?
Well, I mean, I guess I could start with what happened one night. It happened on November 2nd, 2015. I woke up from a nightmare, another nightmare. I'm wiped out. I told people, if you see those movies where somebody's out at sea, they fall off the boat or their boat is smashed up and you've been taking wave after wave for 36 hours. And finally you just think, let the next wave take me. I can't do this. You're in so much pain. And that's what I felt like that night. on November 2nd, 2015. I just thought, I can't do this. So when I woke up from the nightmare, I got all the pills out. I got my water bottle out. And I just said, this is how it ends. I knew those pills would, they would shut down my respiratory system. So I knew. And for some reason, the television was on, which I didn't know then if I was still in the nightmare. And that was my struggle. Sometimes I didn't know if I'm in the nightmare or that I'm really awake. And at that moment, I thought, well, why is this TV on? Is this still the nightmare? Because I set a timer every single night. And this was the only night that timer didn't work. So I have no idea why. And so before taking any pills, I stared at the TV and it was this late night comedy show. It's called The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. Something made me laugh. And at that moment, I paused the TV and I just thought, I'm really awake and there's still something good left in me. And it was just called a moment of like esperanza, of hope. I just thought, I'm going to get on this show someday. And I'm supposed to tell my story just to the world. I don't know how I'm going to get on the show. I don't know how I'm going to tell my story to the world, but I'm not going to go. It's not my time to go yet. There's still something good in me. And it began this journey to recover, to learn how to talk about my story, to process it. And yeah, to get on the Late Show. And the next day I ended up over time, I gave a TEDx talk and just said, something happened the next day and I had the idea. I go out and meet strangers every day. And so for 8 years, every day I've gone out, I've met strangers around the country. They've signed support for me to get on the show, but it's also opened up these huge dialogues about rape, about PTSD, about overcoming. But one of the most important things is about telling somebody besides just yourself. And that's what I learned. But Katie and Claire, I've now met 32,342 strangers, one by one, around this country who have signed support and stories of support for my efforts, not just to get on the show, but in many cases, their stories of how they've been overcoming rape. And they put them in 94 languages on 497 giant foam boards. So someday, somehow, when I get on this show, I'm going to take all these with me and show people that no one walks the journey alone through rape recovery or PTSD recovery.
Whew, what a story. So Blake, you're on this mission, and it sounds like you have been also, in addition to this mission of yours to get on the Colbert Show, you're doing therapy as well. Is that right?
I am. Yeah. And when I failed to tell you, like when I'm going out meeting these people, it's really social engagement therapy, because a lot of the therapists that have worked with me, that's what they coined it. They said, that's how you're getting better. Predominantly, it's just this ability to go out and engage with human beings, because for so long I had isolated and that was what was crushing me. And that was what was moving me closer to suicide every day.
Wow. That's so brilliant. Like, how does I'm curious also about your partner, your husband, how does Sergio help you or support you? And is he away a lot? Because I'm now hearing you say you need social engagement. But is he able to socially engage with you?
Well, he's an airman in the Air Force now, so we're on opposite coasts. I actually just had a surgery within the last year, a hip surgery, which is interesting because people will tell me like, hey, Blake, why haven't you gotten over the rape? Oh, believe me, you guys as survivors that are listening, we hear this. Why haven't you gotten over it? It happened a year ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago. I just had a hip surgery last year from what happened that night of the rape. I've had so many prolonged physical injuries that have lasted much, just equally as much as the mental injuries that I suffered. So anyway, so that has prohibited me at this point from us being together. So we have to communicate long distance at this point, but it's been tough. And then, yeah, but I mean, he knows what I've been through ever since he met me. Well, that's how we met, on the journey. I was going out meeting strangers and he's one of the people that I met along the way. So me putting myself out there, and then he understood that. I mean, now that he's in the military, he really understands. Like, he's meeting people in the military that have been diagnosed with PTSD. So he's understanding of all of that.
So really, you have a long distance relationship, essentially. And that makes it hard when you need that sort of someone to be close and available. How do you negotiate that distance?
I think you take it a day at a time. I think it's just what I've learned about trauma, why it's so destructive for people, is because our lives, for the most part, we have our lives planned out. I mean, think about it. When we all wake up in the morning, we're going to have our cereal or our coffee. We're going to take a shower or we're going to take a bath. We have these routines that we have. So I've learned in life with me and Sergio that you can't always have this routine. You have to be ready for anything. And so when I'm ready for anything, it helps. So, you know, we may not talk at the same time every day, but we talk. something's going to come up with him. We're on a 3-hour difference in time right now. Mm-hmm. So I just, when I wake up now, I say, okay, yeah, I do have things planned, but I'm not so regimented, which is interesting because now he's in the military and there's a great regiment for him. But I've had to learn that I have to be ready for anything. And I have to take the moments that come at me and say, okay, something bad happens today. We're going to have to shift our plans a little bit. Whereas maybe before the trauma, I was very much like, oh no, this has to be done now. I have to take a shower now. I have to eat this time. And again, I still have those routines, but I think I'm a lot more flexible and a lot more understanding. And even with us, when we're communicating with each other, sometimes there have to be changes in that. And we just have to be flexible and understand that we're in different worlds right now. It's in two different coasts.
So, what do you think, though? I'm curious, what are some of the things that Sergio says or does that are the most helpful to you?
Honestly, that he says, talk to me. Let me know. Because sometimes I will hide things from him. I'll hide them from my 4 siblings, my friends. I even hide stuff from my mental health care counselors. One of them had to get in touch with me recently and said, I haven't been hearing from you. When are we going to have our next session? So Sergio just says, listen, Blake, let's talk. Like, don't hide things from me. Tell me what's going on. He wants to be there. He wants to help. So I think he's understanding that I will help the world, but sometimes I'm falling apart. And I feel like I'm trying to help the world or go out there and like write a guest commentary for the Arizona Republic, or in 10 days, I'm going to be speaking in front of like a bunch of elected officials about the intersection of LGBT issues and mental health and LGBT issues. So yeah, I'm doing all that, but Sergio will say, what are you doing to help yourself, Blake? And so I have to be understanding that in that case, yes, he does want to make sure that I'm helping take care of me, because it's like on the airplane, if you got to put your oxygen mask on first and then the people around you, or you're all going down. So
that's right. Absolutely true. Absolutely true. So tell us a little bit about, you're on this mission. Tell us how this is manifesting itself in addition to speaking and gathering signatures. What is your ultimate goal? Because, I mean, let's say you get on the Colbert Show, but there's got to be more than that going on, right?
Well, for me, it means so much to get on the show just because I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for that moment that night. I would have taken, without doubt, I would have taken my life. Something had to happen. I don't know if it's a coincidence that night, whatever. But yes, the Colbert Show is incredibly important to me. It's like the book, The Alchemist by Paulo Coelho, if anybody's heard of that. There were probably a dozen people on this journey that kept saying, you remind me of the book, The Alchemist. And finally, people gave me the book, The Alchemist, and I read it. And the main theme says, when you want something badly enough, the whole world will conspire to help you achieve that. And that's really what's happening here. And I guess, Katie and Claire, the one thing I would say about this is when people ask what would be after the Late Show, I'm not sure. And then the other question I've been asked is, what are you going to say to Stephen Colbert? You've spent 22,000 hours trying to get on the show for 5 minutes. And somebody in the media asked me that somewhat recently. And I said, oh, I'm not sure what I'll say. And they said, how do you not know after 8 years and all those hours? Because I just want to let the moment envelop me. I want the moment to tell me what to say, what to do. And I think because I've been through something so horrific, it wasn't planned. It wasn't on my schedule to be raped that night. It wasn't on my schedule to have the police treat me as dirt. I don't know what else you'd say. When I get on the Late Show, I'll figure out what to say. And I'm going to be so happy that the moment will guide me. And then afterwards, I want the moment to guide me too. Like, what do I do next? Yeah, that's it. And I think that's how I get through life, is that I don't even know what the heck I'm going to do after we're doing our interview today.
I love it, Blake. Well, as we wrap up with this amazing journey you're on, I know and I also want to go back to one thing you said is, when am I going to get over this? This is the way I answer that question, and you're free to use it, Blake. I say, when was the last time someone said, when are you going to get over blank dying, like your grandma, your mom? When are you going to stop mourning the loss of your mom or your dad or your sister or your brother? When are you going to stop hurting because of death and dying? And to me, PTSD and trauma, there's no getting over it ever. There's incorporating it into our lives and learning how to grow stronger and live in a different modality. And I think that's what you taught us tonight too, or today. You're telling us like how you're coping through trauma And thank God for the late show and turning off the TV or turning, hearing something and not ending it. But as we conclude, I would love to hear from you, Blake, like one more message to our listeners, especially because so many of our gay identified men listening will really resonate with your story and your journey. So what would you especially say to them?
Well, and afterwards, can I just share one other thing after that? What would I, first of all, what would I say to like the LGBT community, right?
Yeah, for sure. LGBT and the plus, plus, pluses, all of them, everyone who's like not, go ahead. Yes.
Well, and I wrote a piece. Oh, who did I write a piece for? Just the other day, I wrote something for somebody and said, keep speaking out, because if I would have died by suicide that night in 2015, late 2015, nobody would have heard. They would have heard almost none of my story. I mean, it would have been I would have been so misunderstood. And what I called it was, I would have been another Dixie cup gay statistic. And when I say that, Dixie cups are disposable. So I wanted to use that phrase, a Dixie cup gay statistic, because nobody, if I had taken my life that night, would have understood the full story of what happened. Now I've had a chance. So what would I say to the community, the gay community, or any community, is speak out, tell your story. It starts with you. We make the history. So yes, history happened. We were raped. We went through something horrific, but we have the chance to also impact history by telling our story. And now, when people say, Blake, I get it, you want to get on this show, but why do you keep telling your stories to reporters or writing op-ed pieces or doing this or going in front of groups? Because I'm making history now. I'm not going to be that just Dixie cup gay statistic. I want somebody to hear my story. I want to make history so that generations can say, you know what? He spoke up. This is what happened. These are the changes he made by speaking up. He encouraged somebody to speak up. Then that person encouraged somebody to speak up. And we keep passing it on. So I don't always want, the hope is too, everybody doesn't just leave after listening to this today and say, oh my gosh, I feel so sad for that guy. I'm even going to present, hopefully, a call to action if people want to take that, because I want to see positive come. I want to see calls to action. But that's what I would say to the communities out there.
Yeah. And then what was do you want to add anything else?
Yeah. Well, this is just, again, a call to action, because I thought one of the questions I've been asked, probably one of the top three or four questions I've been asked when I've spoken over these last 8 years, whatever happened to these guys, and do you think you'll get justice? Well, we know who they all are. There's an abundance of evidence. And if anybody out there, a journalist, is listening and you want to do investigative, even if it's 4, 5, 6 of you guys that want to come together, I think we can get the prosecutors in Maricopa County and the police to say there is enough evidence. We can arrest these guys. We can prosecute them. This isn't just about my case, but a lot of people said, Blake, you have so much evidence, so much. I mean, we have a confession from one of the guys, a written voluntary confession that said, yep, I did it. One of the other guys told the police in a formal interview, yep, I saw this guy jump on Blake and take off his underwear and attack him. I mean, there's so much evidence. And I'm tired of rape survivors like myself saying, well, we can't get justice. I'm not mad at us for saying that, but we're told like, oh, it's a 5-year-old case. It's a 10-year-old case. It doesn't matter. If the evidence is there, we need to prosecute. We need to arrest these people. So if there are journalists listening, I'd like you guys to find a way to contact me. Collectively, we can maybe do a piece. And I think if we can get action on my case, I think that could be the impetus to get a lot of action on other rape cases, cold cases around this country, to say, well, they got Blake's case to reopen and they successfully were able to prosecute it. Let's do it with mine. It starts with rolling that stone and getting it tumbling and then building this avalanche. And anyway, that's my call to action, because I didn't want to just come here and tell people a sad story. I think we can turn this into something good if a group of journalists wanted to get together. And even if you're a student journalist, let's do something. I've got a ton of evidence, and I've got the National Women's Law Center that's gotten involved with me. There's a former FBI agent that put together a very compelling reason, like a lot of reasons why this should get prosecuted. And then I have two former federal prosecutors in DC that have worked with me. So there's a huge team. We got a lot of evidence. But I think the part we need now is that journalistic approach to put the pressure on.
And there you have it.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Blake.
Well, thank you guys for letting me share.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Thank you. And Claire, can you close us?
Yes. So again, thank you, Blake, for sharing your story with us today on Dear Katie. And thank you also to our wonderful volunteers who make every aspect of the podcast happen. And thank you to our listeners. And it's from your voices that perhaps we can launch Blake's outreach to journalists, investigative journalists, and people who could get this thing going. Help us help other survivors by subscribing to our podcast. Share it far and wide on your social media, and please follow us on ours. If you need support and don't know where to find it, if you visit takebackthenight.org for a list of resources, you also can find that as well as how to access our legal support hotline. And remember also, self-care is essential to healing and to thriving.
Thanks so much, Claire. And for all of our listeners again, continue to tune in, learn from each episode as you can with our hopeful support of your own healing journey. So take care, and we will talk to you again soon.